Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
In much of the Cotton Belt, it's been warm and dry for the most part in large sections of the Cotton Belt, and that has allowed planting to move along pretty quickly this year so far.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
24% of the intended cotton acreage planted by May 5th. That's ahead of the five-year average of 20%. Also ahead of last year's 20%. We actually saw anywhere from one-fifth to one-quarter of the cotton planted during the week ending May 5th in three states. California jumping from 40 to 65%. Missouri advancing from 10 to 34% planted. And Mississippi going from 12 to 32% planted. So really good progress, especially in California, despite some cool weather.
This is Agriculture Today.
The Ag Economy Barometer Index dropped hard this month from a reading of 114 to a reading of 99. So it's down 15 points compared to a month ago. And that leaves the index 24 points below where it was this time last year.
Dr. Jim Mentert is director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture at Purdue.
The index of current conditions and the index of future expectations both fell pretty hard as well this month. People became less optimistic about what was taking place on their farms today. And they're also starting to show some evidence of being some concerns about where we're headed here over the course of the next year.
Mentert breaks down some of the numbers from the monthly barometer.
Current conditions fell 18 points compared to last month and down 46 points compared to April of 2023. And the future expectation index was down 14 points, both compared to last month and compared to a year ago. So if you think about it in terms of why sentiment dropped, people became less optimistic about what was taking place on their farms today and some concerns about where we're headed here over the course of the next year. And that was really reflected in the Farm Financial Performance Index this month. The index was down 7 points compared to a month ago. But keep in mind that index has been drifting lower really since the end of last year. And now that index is 17 points lower than it was this time last year. So producers are increasingly showing concerns about their financial situation as they look at what's taking place here in 2024. And I think a lot of it obviously is related to the weakness we've seen in crop prices. The Farm Capital Investment Index also fell this month. It was down 10 points compared to a month ago, and that leaves that index down 12 points compared to a year ago. That index reading of 31 is one of the lowest readings we've gotten this low before, but it's only been this low a couple of times. So it's one of the weakest capital investment indexes we've received. And again, I think it ties back to the farm financial performance weakness and the expectations for 2024 being a tough year for a lot of folks, especially crop producers. The short-term farmland value expectation index, after rising last month, actually took a dip this month. It dropped 12 points. This month's reading was 112, down from 124 last month. And if you think about what was taking place there, last month might have been just a little bit of an anomaly with respect to what that index has been doing. That index, except for last month, has been drifting lower since late last year. And so this month might just be kind of a little bit of resumption of that. But clearly, producers are less optimistic about where farmland values are headed over the next 12 months than they were. For example, this time last year, the index was at a reading of 123. 2 years ago, the index was at a reading of 144. And 3 years ago, that index was at a reading of 159. So our survey says that we're still getting more people saying that they expect to see farmland values rise over the next 12 months than expect to see it fall, which is why the index is still positive in the sense that it's above 100. But clearly less optimism than what we saw before. And you can see that when you look at the raw responses to the question, not the index itself. This month, 17% of the people in the survey said that they actually expect to see farmland values weaken or decline over the next 12 months. So I think the second highest reading we've gotten on that over the last roughly 3 or 3.5 years. And only 29% of the producers in the survey said they expect to see farmland values rise over the course of the next 12 months. To put both of those numbers in perspective, a year ago, 14% of the producers in the survey said they thought farmland values might weaken over the next 12 months, and 37% said they thought farmland values were headed higher. So you can kind of see what's taking place there, that erosion of confidence with respect to farmland values.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
There's a unique challenge right now, trying to be able to get bipartisanship when you've got a one-vote majority in the House, a one-vote majority in the Senate. So we are literally equally divided. Can't be any closer than that. But we have to be able to get more people involved.
Oklahoma Senator James Lankford.
So key things for me as I go back to, there's a season. We missed our window.
Yeah.
If we'd have gotten it done 2 months earlier than that, we'd have been able to move it. The problem was it wasn't ripe at that point. The text wasn't ready. I would have loved to have had it done in December. It's not like we were dragging our feet. Border bills are incredibly technical in their language. I talk to my team all the time saying nothing moves fast in the Senate until it does. So at that moment that it moves fast, you've either got to be ready because the American people are talking about it, the press is talking about it, and people are saying, I want to do something. If you don't have the legislation ready that day, you missed your window. So you've got to be proactive to be able to have everything written, prepared, and ready to go. In this situation, we couldn't do that. We're dealing with a bipartisan negotiation. We've got to sit down with people that just disagree. My running joke with Chris Murphy the whole time, Chris Murphy from Connecticut, progressive from Connecticut, conservative from Oklahoma, independent from Arizona, where Kirsten's dealing with ground zero every day. I would joke with Chris Murphy all the time, the only border he's worried about is the border with New York. Okay, he's from Connecticut. I'm again, this is just not a thing that they have to think about all the time. We do in Oklahoma, Kyrsten Sinema does every day in Arizona. So when it was time to be able to move it, we had to be able to have it ready. It wasn't ready at the moment, and the moment passed us.
At the Milliken Institute's 2024 Global Conference, Senator Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona.
Had we had our product ready in December, we would have had the votes. But I think it's important to note that we didn't have a product ready in December because folks were still going through the process of learning and growing and grieving because it was a significant border security package. And in fact, some of you might recall the Wall Street Journal editorial said that it was the strictest immigration proposal in over 40 years. But in December of 2023, the White House and Chris Murphy, who represented the vast majority of the Senate Democratic Caucus, were not yet ready to agree to the proposals, which ultimately ended up in the package, which, of course, James and I had been saying all along, we've got to get these elements into the package. And so you've got both the political moment that you have to consider, but there's also human nature that you have to consider. You can't ask folks to go from here to here in 6 weeks, right? Emotionally, they can't manage the movement of a policy position from over here to over here in a matter of 6 weeks. It takes time for folks to emotionally metabolize the changes, to understand what must be given in order to get the ultimate goal or the outcome. And that couldn't be rushed. And so I'm not sure what lesson you take from that, Alan, for the future, except to say that the earlier you start tackling these large issues, the more time that folks on both edges of the spectrum have time to go through the five stages of grief to metabolize the compromise that will ultimately result from the negotiation. And that's something I think that is overlooked during the process of negotiations. As people think, oh, this is so technical and difficult, let's not overlook the emotional difficulty that folks have in changing their opinions of what they're willing to live with to get to the outcome.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
You know, it's very interesting here in the United States. We've seen a great interest in expanding the dairy processing industry, and this is something that's not going on in other parts of the world, and is really very unique to the United States.
Kansas State Dairy Specialist Dr. Mike Brook.
During the years from 2023 through 2025, we expect to see over $6 billion invested in milk processing across the United States. And this will be in various facilities. And here in Kansas, we're going to benefit from what's going on down in Dodge City with the new Hillmar plant there. So we're seeing a rapid expansion of dairy processing. And as we think about that, as dairy producers, one of the questions that might come to your mind is, where is the milk going to come from? And that is a concern that's being addressed. We are seeing some farms expand here in Kansas as well as in neighboring states to increase the amount of milk produced here in our area to help supply that new plant that's being built in Dodge City. As we look around the United States, though, this may be a little more difficult than what one might think. You know, in the past, we've enjoyed a surplus of dairy heifers available as we wanted to expand the dairy herd. Although today, that is not true, as we see our dairy heifer herd in the United States actually the smallest that it's been in a long, long time. And as we look at it as a percentage of the total cow herd in the United States, our current number of animals ready to calve will only be about 28% of the milking herd size. So this is going to limit the expansion of the dairy herd to meet the demand that is created by these new plants that we're building to process milk. So what does that mean for you as an individual dairy farm? Well, I know right now as we look at that milk price and we see it slip into the summer months, you're probably not too encouraged by what you're seeing. However, as we think about longer term and the demand that there will be for raw milk, this increased processing capabilities will likely result in an increased demand for milk. Now, your raw milk is going to be needed because we actually do need to expand the amount of dairy product that's available to consumers, not only in this country, but also abroad as we think of exports. So the reason we're seeing a lot of expansion in the dairy processing industry is the fact that there is a need for increased volume of dairy product for the grocery shelves here in the United States as well as abroad. So long term, that means that we should see a higher demand for raw milk to fill those processing plants. If we have a limit on how fast we can expand herds, that should mean that we should see some increases in the prices that you receive on your farms. So as we look to the future, I think the future of the dairy industry, particularly in terms of this increased dairy processing capabilities, will actually work to improve the financial situation on our dairy farm by leading to higher prices for our raw milk.
U.S. dairy exports posted a February record, 17.3% of U.S. milk solids production equivalent, even as domestic commercial use of milk in all products showed its first monthly drop since January of 2023. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Farmer sentiment declined sharply in April, as indicated by the latest Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer. It fell 15 points from March to a reading of 99, and both sub-indexes of the barometer also declined. Current condition index dropped by 18 points to 83. Futures index fell by 14 to 106.
One of the things that we've been tracking in the Ag Economy Barometer survey going back to June of 2021 is the activity that's been taking place with respect to leasing farmland for the installation of a solar energy project.
Dr. Jim Mentert is director for the Center for Commercial Ag.
The first time we asked this question was in June of 21. And the question was phrased along these lines. It said, have you actively engaged in discussions with any companies about leasing farmland you own for the installation of a solar energy project to generate electricity? In June of 2021, just 9% of the producers in the survey said that they'd had a discussion with a company about solar energy leasing. That's drifted upwards over time. You go back this time last year, and in April of 23, I think 15% of the producers in the survey said they'd had a discussion. And then here this winter, we actually changed the question a little bit. The last couple of times we've asked the question, we've asked people to focus on activity that had taken place in the last 6 months. And so in February, I think that was a 10% response indicating they'd had a discussion. In March, it was up a little bit to 12%. And this month, it actually jumped to 19%. So almost one out of five producers in the survey said they'd had a discussion with a company about leasing farmland for solar energy in the last 6 months. That's a significant jump, and it's going to be interesting to see on future surveys if that holds up or if that response rate this month was a bit of an anomaly. And then we did the follow-up question, which is to ask people, what is the annual payment rate per acre that they were offered to lease some of their farmland for the installation of a solar energy project to generate electricity? And again, starting earlier this year, starting with the March survey, we only posed this question to those who said they had engaged in a discussion with companies in the last 6 months. And we made a change to the response categories. So when people respond to this question, they are allowed to choose from several possible responses. And those responses are less than $500 an acre, $500 to $750 an acre, $750 up to $1,000, and then $1,000 or more. The last two times we asked this question, though, we broke that $1,000 or more into two subcategories, which are $1,000 up to $1,250, and then a $1,250 or more category. And that's really probably what's most interesting in terms of the responses. These last two surveys, we've picked up quite a few people, lease rates of over $1,000. In the most recent survey here in April, it was 58% of the people saying they were offered over $1,000 an acre. 30% of the people in the survey said that they were offered a rate of $1,000 up to $1,250, and 28% said they were offered $1,250 or more. And so if you look at the data, if you look at our surveys going back to 2021, it's pretty clear that the lease rates for solar energy production are rising over time, not uniformly in the sense that we still get, for example, this month, 16% of the people in the survey said they were offered a rate of less than 500, 12% said they were offered 500 to 750. But it's clear the upper end is moving up. And we suspect some of that's geographically related. We suspect, although our survey isn't large enough to really discern this, but we suspect that those higher lease rates are probably in areas where farmland lease rates are higher, for example, in the Corn Belt. And then obviously in some areas where the demand for solar energy, for whatever reason, is higher than in some other locales.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
First, as we all know, I launched a grand experiment about whether or not an independent could survive in today's political climate, and the experiment failed. So let me just put that out there.
Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema at the Milken Institute's Global Conference.
I do think there's a real difference, and the data would support this, between an open primary and ranked choice voting. Arizona is a state that has had open primaries for quite some time. And the largest group of registered voters in Arizona are independent, no party affiliated. Those two facts are significant. But if you take a look at participation in Arizona's primaries, they still behave like closed primaries. Because the data shows that independents, while they are the largest group of registered voters in my state, do not participate in the primary election whatsoever. So the primaries continue to behave like a closed primary, which is where the most extreme individual who hews closest to the farthest edge of the party line is the victor of the primary. Now, that is different than a ranked choice voting, where all the candidates are on the ballot at once, and where there is a real actual disincentive for negative campaigning, because not only can you say you don't like the target of the negative campaigning, you can say you don't like the genesis of the negative campaigning. So I would encourage you to take a look at the data separately from open primaries to ranked choice voting, because the behavior and the voting patterns of those who participate is different in those two settings. But I think there's another element of this, Alan, that is important to note, and that is, as I said, in Arizona, the largest group of registered voters are independents who do not feel like they're being served by either party. But when asked who they will vote for, even those individuals largely fall along party lines, because in our current political climate, they are more afraid of the other party than they are willing to say no to the excess of the party with which they are slightly less offended by. And so the partisanship has actually gotten even more extreme, even with the growth of things like open primaries, ranked choice voting, and others. So I would suggest that while there are mechanisms that could help, like ranked choice voting, there isn't actually a legislative solution to this challenge. It is a cultural solution.
It is.
We must, in our culture, decide that as Americans, we want to support someone with whom we only agree with 60% of the time. We must choose to say, it's okay that I disagree with him 20 or 30 or 40% of the time because of his integrity, because I believe he believes in the Constitution, because he's standing up for the core values that we share, even if we aren't aligned on every policy perspective or each vote. I can't tell you, Alan, the number of times that someone has come up to me and said, you know, Kirsten, I used to just love you, but then you took this one vote and I'll never support you again because I can't agree with you on this one thing. And what I always say to that individual is I really thank you for your opinion, but I do want you to know that if you meet an elected official with whom you agree with 100%, either he is lying to you or you're not thinking for yourself. And both of those are deeply, deeply dangerous to the long-term health of a democracy. Fair, so yeah. We as Americans must address both of those issues.
Oklahoma Republican Senator James Lankford.
I'd be the skunk in the garden party on the issue of ranked choice voting. Don't agree with that. I think it takes away trust because the math and the formula is kind of behind the scenes and you can't see it. And you can't really tell who the winner is. And it's hard to be able to track that until several days later. And it allows for a lot of mischief in the process of just misinformation. And that's one of the big challenges that we have right now is clarity.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The newly finalized EID, electronic identification rule from USDA, is really more of an update to the 2013 animal disease traceability rule.
Ethan Lane is Vice President, Government Affairs, National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
That is the rule that established requirements for sexually intact cattle over 18 months, basically breeding stock, moving interstate, as well as rodeo cattle, bison, and dairy cattle, requiring those classes of cattle and no other classes to have an official ID tag in order to cross state lines. So over the last 11 years, that has typically come in the form of a bright tag, a metal ear tag. But this rule updates that requirement. And moving forward, starting 6 months from the finalization of this rule, which would be about November 1st of this year, the requirement for that class of cattle to move interstate will be what they're calling a visually and electronically readable ID tag. So an 840 tag is the best example of that. So that will be the new requirement. The class of cattle for beef cattle remains the same. The general structure of that program remains the same. This is effectively an upgrade in the technology or a change in the technology that's being used. And you know, critically, what they've done here is switch from years of the industry and USDA and others talking about RFID tags, radio frequency ID tags, to EID. And they say in this final rule that the reason for that is to make note of the fact that technology continues to evolve. And they don't believe RFID is the final word here in what will be an effective technology. You know, clearly anyone who's worked on this issue knows that high frequency works in some places and not in others, and the same for low frequency. There are all kinds of issues with that technology, and USDA is sort of presuming in this rule that the marketplace is going to have some additional solutions out there in the years to come. Nevertheless, that is kind of the structure of what we're looking at, and that rule will go into effect November 1st for producers around the country. In the meantime, they will be able to use those metal tags to put those breeding stock into compliance and basically grandfather themselves in under the old system should they wish to do that. But after that 6 month date in the fall, they will have to use that new form of ID for cattle that are meeting that description and moving interstate.
And talks about cattlemen having a voice.
2 weeks ago, we had more than 300 of our members from all of those states here in town for our legislative conference. It's an event we hold in Washington every spring, and it's just that. It's an opportunity for our producers to be up on the Hill, to talk to their members of Congress, talk to their senators, meet with federal agencies, and make those opinions known. It's a great opportunity both to carry the NCBA message, but also for those states to carry their own individual messages. You know, we work on a lot of issues here at NCBA, and Tony, you've been in our office here in Washington. We have a one-page flyer for every issue you can think of in the cattle industry, and it's always interesting to watch our states prepare their materials to go to Capitol Hill because, you know, if you're a Western state, you might have a one-pager in there on the gray wolf being listed under the Endangered Species Act. But if you're from West Virginia or Florida, that may not be as hot a topic in your delegation. So, you see those different groups picking and choosing, but I think almost all of those states I went to the Hill here 2 weeks ago, at least wanting to touch on the topic of traceability, wanting to tell legislators they appreciated the $15 million that was appropriated for tags and equipment to make sure our producers aren't bearing the cost of implementing this rulemaking. That's something we worked very hard on throughout the last year. So this is one of those issues that definitely has bubbled to the top and is on folks' list from coast to coast right now.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
After several weeks of deteriorating condition ratings for the winter wheat crop, things have largely stabilized over this past week.
As some of the drier areas of the Central Plains picking up some much-needed moisture.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey told us as we begin this week, here's how the crop's doing.
Exactly one half of the crop nationally rated good to excellent, 16% very poor to poor. A week ago, those numbers were at 49% good to excellent and an equal amount, 16% rated very poor to poor.
And despite some wet weather,
we still see a pretty hefty number for wheat heading by May 5th, 43%, ahead of the five-year average of 32%, ahead of last year's 34%.
Meanwhile, farmers are planting spring wheat. They've got 47% of it in the ground, far ahead of average of 31%. Gary Crawford, Washington.